Well, here we are. With people all over the world celebrating this day. How nice it comes on a Saturday. Very helpful. And how nice we have it to celebrate. In the Soto tradition, we split up all the different anniversaries of Buddha, and so they happen all during the year. Most other traditions cobble them all together and do them in the spring. So there are many flowers and bathing the baby Buddha, and everything all goes in, mourning the death, and everything happens at the same time. But here we just focus one by one, and this one is the most special one, because it's considered to be not just Shakyamuni Buddha's experience, but the experience that we've inherited. And that the mind of Buddha is the mind that he awakened to, is the same mind. It was not some new and different thing that is told about from generation to generation. It isn't passed along in like a family pearls or something. It's a recognition of something that already was, is. And like all of us, he worked hard toward it. Very, very hard. And the story of it always especially pleases me, because in spite of how esoteric it sounds, it's all in India and there's a yoga tradition and all of that, it isn't any different from what we know ourselves. In fact, it was for Buddha very humbling and very a long journey and passing through many, many difficulties before he was able to sit down and really face what was there, here. So I thought I would share with you, I love this book, Nana Moli's book called The Life of Buddha. And it's he put together all passages from the different sutras in chronological order, which the Indian people don't do. They don't bother about what comes then and then and then. They just pick up things and show it. So he pulled those out and tried to put the oldest ones together into the story of Buddha's life, including his enlightenment. And so I thought I would just review it with you shortly. It isn't an academic piece of knowledge, but it's important for us to understand where this came from, because we're the embodiment of it now. When Buddha left home, he went first. We often think of him going into the forest, but he didn't go to the forest first. He went to the most famous teacher in the land, the greatest philosopher, Alara Kalama, and became his best student. He was teaching concentration. And there are many, many concentration practices, and I'm sure that Buddha did a lot of them, focusing on a candle, sitting beside a river and focusing on the sound of the river. Those kinds of concentration practices are very, very ancient, and probably Lucy and her kin did it too. They found a baby Lucy these days. It's really cool. There are a couple of them now. But the base there in concentrating was, the basis was nothingness. You concentrate until your head is empty and you experience what was called nothingness. And Buddha said, well, that was fine, but there wasn't any direct knowledge. There just wasn't anything there. And when I stood up, it didn't help me. I was still the same. So he went to the second best philosopher in town, and that was Udaka Ramaputta. And he had a basis consisting of neither perception or non-perception, also a nihilistic kind of view, and a total erasure of everything. And he wasn't satisfied. But he was offered the leadership of that Sangha also. He said, you did the best in this. And he said, yeah, but it doesn't lead to dispassion or to peace or to direct knowledge. He was looking for the experience of it, not the idea. So, it says, then he dwelt in fear and dread in awe-inspiring forest shrines. He scared himself on purpose. He wanted to face his fears. And practiced to crush his mind with his mind. It's a horrible vision. I practiced to crush my mind with my mind, striving to subdue myself. With unremitting mindfulness, I was overwrought and uncalm. So he really, really tried hard. He stopped breathing. And then he got a horrible stomach ache, and his head felt like it was being hacked in two. He said, such painful feelings that arose in me gained no power over my mind. So I had to keep going, so I stopped eating. And then somebody said, you know, you're going to die if you don't eat. So he said, I'll just eat a little handful. And so he was doing that, and he said his backside became like a camel's hoof, and his belly touched his spine. And he realized there was no distinction in him besides being a very hungry human being. Nothing had changed. And then he remembered a childhood experience. And this is, I thought of a time when my Shakyan father was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual desires, secluded from unprofitable things I had entered upon and abode in the first meditation, which is accompanied by thinking and exploring with happiness and pleasure born of seclusion. I thought, might that be the way to enlightenment? Then following up that memory, there came the recognition that this was the way to enlightenment. Then I thought, why am I afraid of such pleasure? It is pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual desires and unprofitable things. Then I thought, I am not afraid of such pleasure, for it has nothing to do with sensual desires and unprofitable things. I thought, it is not possible to attain that pleasure with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and bread. So that was the beginning. And I like to remember that because it's so easy to get into that original ambitious way that he started out with, and we all do. We all carry an ambition of success and perfection in ourselves, which we carry into our practice, and begin to imagine that that's what the meaning of the practice is, that it's polishing things until we're perfect. In one sense, it is. So that there's a famous story about the monk who was practicing, and when the master asked him what he was doing, he said, I'm practicing to be a Buddha. And the master said, well, you know, it's like polishing a mirror with a rock? Anyway, it's an impossible thing. But later on, he encouraged him to do that very thing. So it's not like they don't live together. And much of the challenge of our practice is how to keep balanced out from the way-seeking mind that keeps us eager to practice, and the other mind that understands that there's another side that isn't like that. When Buddha ate, he then sat down. And he sat for, people don't agree for how long. Some people say it was just a week, a few weeks, a day. When you go there, you hear a lot of different stories. It's wonderful to go there, even though it's a very noisy, dirty little town, bigger town now probably since I was there. But it's beside the river. And the kin of the tree that he sat on is there. The tree he sat under died after many, many years. They're beautiful. They're sort of like these trees. They're kind of poplar trees or sycamores, that smooth bark. And when the tree died, before it died, they took a piece of it to Sri Lanka and grew another tree from it. And then when the tree was dying, they took a piece from that tree, and that's what is there now. So it's very cool to sit under it. It's a huge old tree now, and it has a little fence around it so that you have to ask permission to go inside and sit down. And sitting, he attained what he called three true knowledges. Following, he said, his development of meditation, which was diligent, ardent, and self-controlled. And I think that's the best advice for our meditation that we can have, to be diligent and ardent. I love that. And self-controlled. So it's bringing our faith and our devotion, our care, and our tremendous energies into this one thing, this one activity. And what he attained was a recollection of past lives, which doesn't look like I was the king of this and the prince of that. It wasn't like that at all. The past lives was I directed, I inclined my mind to the knowledge of recollection of past life. I recollected my manifold past life, that is to say, one birth, two, three, four, five births, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 births, 100, 1,000, 100,000 births, many ages of world contraction, many ages of world expansion, many ages of world contraction and expansion. I was there, so named, of such a race with such an appearance, such food, such experience of pleasure and pain, such a life term. And passing away thence, I reappeared elsewhere, and there too I was so named, of such a race, such appearance, such experience of pleasure and pain, such a life term. Thus, with details and particulars, I recollected my manifold past life. This was the first true knowledge attained by me. So, it can be believed that this is about reincarnation and that he himself had all these lives. Or, in our own experience of our own mind, we experience and feel connected to everything that ever happened before. I just mentioned Lucy. When we discover something from the past, we feel our relationship so that our knowledge is not that it's just me here in 2012, but me includes all those others, and the more we know about all those others, we know how they suffered and how they enjoyed and how they learned and all the things it is to be human. That has been going on for 10,000, 12,000 years. So he saw the whole picture of us as humanity and lived it, as we can do also, and do as we connect. His second view was of creatures being born and dying. Now this is more intimate. So then he inclined his mind to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of creatures. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw creatures passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, happy and unhappy in their destinations. I understood how creatures pass on according to their actions. These worthy creatures who were ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, revilers of noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in states of privation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. But these worthy creatures who were well conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers, right in their views, giving effect to right views, have reappeared in a happy destination, even in a heavenly world. Thus I saw creatures passing away and reappearing. I understood how creatures pass on according to their actions. This was the second true knowledge attained by me. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens to one who is diligent, ardent, and self-controlled. So this is the sort of basic view of reincarnation according to the tradition of karma. And although in my view there's no way to know about this, and Buddha already said this is not a kind of question even ask about heaven or hell or what happens after death in another place. But this is so useful as a psychological insight into how we operate. If things in our mind aren't going well, we taste the fruit of it, and vice versa. And sometimes it takes a while, but there's always an effect that comes after a cause. And then the cause creates a new effect, which is another way of thinking of karma. We are a cause as well as an effect. We happen, and our happening itself, especially how our mind is working, then creates whatever the next outcome is going to be. So if we're harsh and unforgiving, whoever is receiving that harshness and non-forgivingness then takes on that karma of being rejected. And that has a long-term effect that goes all the way out to who knows how far. So we don't have very much power, but that's the place where we have power. That's the place where we can actually do something. For good or for ill. And Buddha's advice, when he gave us the Four Noble Truths, was to cultivate the good and don't cultivate the ill. He didn't say throw it away because you can't throw it away. It's all of a piece. We take part in all of it. But we can choose which way to act our life. And of course we have 1,000 regrets because many times our choices are stupid, and we need to ask forgiveness and face our regrets and then go on. So those are his basic experience under the tree. At least in the beginning. But he went on to put them together in a lot of different ways. And one of them was the view of creatures of the Four Noble Truths. So which I can't find. I directed, I inclined my mind to the knowledge of exhaustion of taints. I had direct knowledge, as it actually is, that this is suffering, that this is the origin of suffering, that this is cessation of suffering, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. I had direct knowledge, as it actually is, that these are taints, that this is the origin of taints, that this is the cessation of taints, and that this is the way leading to the cessation of taints. Knowing thus and seeing thus, my heart was liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of being, and from the taint of ignorance. When liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated. I had direct knowledge, birth is exhausted, the holy life has been lived out, what was to be done is done, there is no more of this to come. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose, darkness was banished and light arose. But I allowed no such pleasant feeling as arose in me to gain power over my mind. That's really important. Otherwise, no, and people do this, you know, I got it, look at me. Isn't this cool? Isn't this happy? But it's not like that. And I love so much these Four Noble Truths because they're so ordinary. They're not promising castles, jewels, riches, long life, no suffering. They simply point out that we create our own suffering by our grasping and our aversion, and we don't need to. And the best way of dealing with those things is not to go to a psychotherapist or a magician and have them wave a magic wand, but to live a decent life, to develop a kind mind and kind speech and a good job, and spend a lot of time in meditation and mindfulness, to maintain a view that keeps us in the present so that we can clearly be with what needs to be, and so we can be of some help. It's so very, very simple. And yet it's the most essential thing. It's where it happens. It's how it's able to work, even though it looks so plain. So then he went on to develop the knowledge of dependent arising, which is how everything is connected. In this chain of causation is called pratityasamutpada, which starts out with ignorance and carries on through the whole accumulation of a body and emotions and sensations all the way through to birth and death, which then give rise to ignorance again. And so this chain is, whether it's true in terms of reincarnation, which many people believe, or it's psychologically true moment by moment, it's up to us to choose. In my view, it's very helpful psychologically. Once ignorance arises, everything arises from there that hampers us, you could say. And this chain is something that, in the story of it, we've inherited. Unlike all the other beings in the world, we can step out of it. We've been, as human beings, we have developed so far that we are actually able to step out of it, not by thinking. In fact, thinking keeps us there. But by releasing ourselves and submitting ourselves to the truth of it, actually acknowledging and accepting how we are, how it is, getting real clarity about how form, emptiness, the human body itself, as it takes in information and sends it out again, all of those things in which we're entangled, all of them are an experience that each one of us individually are having. It isn't out there anywhere. It's all in here. So when we get agitated about something that's happening out there, it's all happening. The agitation is my agitation. It's not that one's. So, one thing conditions another. as we know. So life conditions death, you could say. And then death conditions another life. Birth is there where aging and death come to be. Birth is a necessary condition for them. Where does birth come to be? Being is there when birth comes to be. Being is a necessary condition for that. When does being come to be? Clinging is there when being comes to be. Clinging is a necessary condition for that. Craving is there when clinging comes to be. Feeling of pleasure and pain is there when craving comes to be. Contact is there when feeling comes to be. The sixfold base for contact, the body, is there when contact comes to be. I thought, what is there when the sixfold base comes to be? Name and form is there. I thought, where, when name and form come to be? Consciousness is there. Consciousness is a necessary condition for that. Where did consciousness come from? With ordered attention, I came to understand name and form is there when consciousness comes to be. When consciousness, this consciousness turns back upon itself. It does not extend beyond name and form. And this is how it happens, whether one is being born, aging, or dying, passing away, or reappearing. It is with name and form as condition that consciousness comes to be, with consciousness as condition, name and form as condition, sixfold base, with sixfold base, contact, with contact, feeling, with feeling, craving, with craving, clinging, with clinging, being, with being, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death come to be, and also sorrow and lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. This is how there is an origin to this whole aggregate mass of suffering. The origin, such was the insight, the knowledge, the understanding, the vision, the light that arose in me about ideas not heard before. I thought, what is not there when no aging and death come to be? With the cessation of what is there, cessation of aging and death? Then with ordered attention I came to understand when there is no birth, no aging and death. With the cessation of birth, there is cessation of aging and death. Where there is no being, no birth. No clinging, no being, no craving, no clinging, no feeling, no craving, no contact, no feeling, no sixfold base, no contact, name and form, no sixfold base. When there is no consciousness, no name and form comes to be. Then I thought, what is not there when no consciousness comes to be? With cessation of what is there, cessation of consciousness? Then I came to understand when there is no name and form, no consciousness comes to be. With cessation of name and form, there is cessation of consciousness. I thought this is the path to enlightenment that I have now reached. That is to say, the cessation of name and form there is cessation of consciousness. And etc. He said, suppose a man wandering in a forest wilderness found an ancient path, an ancient trail traveled by men of old, and he followed it up, and by doing so, he discovered an ancient city where men of old had lived, with parks and groves and lakes walled round and beautiful to see. So I too found the ancient path, the ancient trail traveled by the fully enlightened ones of old. And what was that ancient path, that ancient trail? It was this noble eightfold path, that is to say, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Thank you. So when he was done, there's also a description of the right judgment of the world of conditioned acts and ideas. In the case of each bodily pleasure and mental joy that arise in dependence on the five categories of form, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness, are the gratification. The fact that these things are all impermanent, painful, and subject to change is the danger. The disciplining and abandoning of desire and lust for them is the escape. As long as I did not know by direct knowledge, as it actually is, that such was the gratification, such the danger, and such the escape, in the case of this body, these five categories affected by clinging, so long did I make no claim to have discovered the enlightenment that is supreme in the world. But as soon as I knew by direct knowledge, as it actually is, that such is the gratification, the danger, and such the escape, then I claim to have discovered the enlightenment that is supreme in the world, with its deities, its maras, and its divinities in this generation, with its monks and Brahmins, with its princes and men. My deliverance is unassailable. This is my last birth. There is now no renewal of being. And then there's a poem that he was supposed to have chanted. Seeking but not finding the house builder, I traveled through the round of countless births. Oh, painful is birth ever again. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build the house again. Your rafters have been broken down. Your ridgepole is demolished, too. My mind has now attained the unformed nibbana and reached the end of every kind of craving. And the way we celebrate this is to sit. And to recognize that our thinking mind is only a small piece of what we are able to know, experience. And that if we depend on our thinking mind, we are crippling ourselves and blinding ourselves, and that the path to the ancient city is very simple. It's sitting zazen and opening up to how very, very, very big the mind can be. Is always and can be lived. That was Buddha's gift to us. Not that he had an experience so much as that he got up and was willing to spend the next 50 years, 40 years, being with people. Every kind of people. And sharing the mind. So that's what I brought. I recommend this book. There are questions, comments? Donald.
grasping or the clinging to wanting things to be good and right comes up, and for me it just comes up in the most interesting ways. I think I'm fairly insightful, and it just shows up in the weirdest way. Mark and I worked on a 1,000-piece puzzle.
Ooh.
Of the wheel of life.
Cool.
It was really interesting. And so putting together the wheel, or the
dependent origination, ignorance, and yes.
So it's so interesting. So my mind said, okay, I'm putting the death thing together first, and then I'll be able to put the top. I couldn't find a piece for the death thing. I couldn't finish it. It was very interesting. So, I'll just move to the next thing, you know, through birth and life. I said, this would be easy to do. I mean, this is so interesting. Mm-hmm. So there's a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, and I'm thinking how I'm going to do this, right? Working my way through life, right? And, anyway, it's very, very later on that I was able to find the piece for death. And what was so interesting, at the end, everything was all done except for the realm of the hungry ghosts and the swimming in the flames of hell. And so interesting. It wasn't even, you know, again, I abandoned my mind by then because we were like on 875 pieces. You know, I'm really into it. It's just so interesting how ingrained it is as a, for me, it feels so ingrained as a person. And then at the same time, what Buddha offers us is so, how do you say it, ordinary. And I always think of when he touches the earth. At this time, he is awesome. I think it's really amazing. Yeah. For me, I can't get away from myself. Shows up in a puzzle. Okay, thank you, yeah. I appreciate the story most. Mm. Thank you, Angie.
Angie?
Yes.
I wonder whether Buddha ever talked about dreams, because I just dream so much. And I'll have, you know, a very quiet day, very uneventful. And then I go to sleep and, you know, it's like I can barely rest.
Yes.
Yes. The dreams just take over. And I wake up and I sometimes feel exhausted. Once in a while, I have a very calming, lovely dream. But that's not too often. And it's kind of a mystery to me. You know, we go through a day and not much happened. But it's like a lot happened that we're not even aware of.
Yes.
It does come out.
Well, maybe because you lead such a quiet life, your interior life has to get all stirred up. Buddha did dream. Where is that part? He tells his dreams.
Is that part of the stages?
Just before the perfect one, accomplished and fully enlightened, attained enlightenment, 5 momentous dreams appeared to him. While he was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, the great earth was his couch. Himalaya, king of the mountains, was his pillow. His left hand lay in the eastern ocean. His right hand lay in the western ocean. His feet lay in the southern ocean. This was the first dream that appeared to him. I had a daughter-in-law who had a dream just like this. She just, her whole body was extended over the whole earth. A creeper grew out of his navel and stood touching the clouds. This was the second dream that appeared to him. He was white grubs with black heads crawled from his feet to his knees and covered them. This was the third dream. And it foretold that many white-clothed laymen would go for refuge to the Perfect One during his life. Well, four birds of different colors came from the four quarters, and as they alighted at his feet, they all became white. This was the fourth dream. And it foretold that the four castes, the warrior nobles, the Brahmin priests, the burgesses, the plebeians, would realize the supreme deliverance when the law and the discipline had been proclaimed. He walked upon a huge mountain of dirt without being fouled by the dirt. And this foretold that he would get the requisites of robes, alms, food, a mode, and medicine, and yet he would use them without greed or delusion or clinging. So he did dream.
Fantastic dreams.
Yeah, really. Mm-hmm. Do you write your dreams?
Well, usually they're so fragmented that I don't, although recently I had a dream that was very clear. Mm-hmm. I didn't write it down, but I remember the images so clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a fantastic dream. Seeing this dragon cloud, and I don't know whether I was becoming the dragon, but it was this beautiful, colorful dragon undulating.
Mm.
And it just stuck with me for a long time, that image.
Yeah.
But it may be a good way to help practice.
They are. I think so. I think they're very important. Yeah. And sometimes it helps to return to a dream or in waking mind and don't try to figure them out so much as just continue the story in a way, mm-hmm. or the image.
Mm-hmm.
Let the image continue to live in you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good question. Jeffrey?
I want to thank Dylan for that. I never heard a discussion about dreams. And I certainly have very vivid dreams. And they strike me as being very important to me. In my dreams, I dream a lot about people, like people who have passed on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way of being connected. And so I've always really valued when I have a dream like that with whoever it is. And I've never had a dream that was unsettling. They were always, you know, the kind of dream you wake up and it's much like you say, you just kind of stay with the image. Or,
mm-hmm.
In fact, I had a dream about you last week, and you were about 20 years younger than you are now in the dream. And I thought about that at length, about why did I have a dream about Angie, and she's about 55. We have all kinds of dreams, but they're all, it seems to me, I seldom have a dream that is really unsettling, or I find I wish I had had that dream, that kind of dream.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had many dreams that they were like an absolute gift.
Yeah.
But thank you. I've never talked about dreams before. Thank you very much. It was great.
Don?
I just had one quick thought about about the whole story of Buddha's enlightenment, and one thing that didn't seem to come out in all of what you read that I kept expecting to hear was the looking at the whatever star it was and having this epiphany, this understanding. And it also keeps coming up with the Maka Sayapa or whatever, when Buddha held the flower and the transmission was made. And so I'm just fascinated by the thought, even if I have this underlying sense that enlightenment doesn't come in a flash like I thought it did when I read books when I was younger. But it didn't come up in that book, and I'm just curious about that. Is it in there somewhere and I missed it, or was that just kind of a different way of how he experienced what led up to that?
It was a different way.
Okay.
It's just, that is a really old story too, and I usually tell it, but I thought this time I would leave it out, because it sounds like such a great, gorgeous thing, and I wanted to emphasize the ordinariness of it. Yeah. But Donalyn is right, the best part is when he touched the earth. You know, he'd been striving toward the heaven all these years and finally realized that it wasn't up there. It was right here. Right here. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
I think it was the morning star.
Morning star.
And White Cloud took on. He just writes such a really, it's fun. Fun. Very easy read story of what a Buddha's life. Mm. He makes it very. He fills in a lot of little details about who was the young woman or servant that served in his first meal.
Yes.
And, all this. It's only my mom can do.
Well, he pulled all the stories together. There are many, many stories that piled up through the centuries, and they get more and more elaborate as they get older and farther away from Buddha. So what Nanamoli tried to do is to carve those away and get back to as close to the original as he could get.
It's a huge book, and I was always afraid to read it in White Cloud, but it's very easy.
Oh, it's easy. It's
very easy.
Well, it's almost 2, so maybe we should, if there are not any more questions. Any more? Well, let's sit.